Right.
I move to go down the pub.
Well, I mean, what's going on? Well, I mean, it's
Pat's, nice. Pat's got a hand up. Yes, sir. Pat.
Oh,
right, sorry.
Can you tell us why
I think the main difference being that Germany was an advanced capitalist state with every prospect of if Germany had fallen or had been able to stretch much more across the centre of Europe and be able to withstand on its own terms. And it was an advanced capitalist state with a longer history of conscious working class organisation and activity. So it brings, and it was also an advanced capitalist state in which the state did not self-destruct. Because I tend to take the view that if you look at the history of similar revolutions, there's a few of them across Europe throughout the 20th century where previously backward feudal states have managed to come forward into capitalism with the working class in advance of the capitalist class. So Portugal, Spain, Germany, Italy, Russia. The tendency has been that there's, as the working class rise up during the progression of the introduction of capitalism, the capitalists have to fall back on some form of highly authoritarian dictatorial state. They can't afford themselves to pursue democracy as an immediate goal, as did the English and French bourgeoisies. So within terms of that sort of strata of examples, it forms, I would say, it's just a typical case, whereas Russia is atypical in that the state, it was the most backward of all, economically and politically, and the state self-destructed in Russia, more or less, it disintegrated before their very eyes. So, for socialists trying to draw conclusions from these events, I think it's much better to look at the supposed failures of Germany, Portugal, and Spain, where Bolshevik ideas were even tried and failed, than compared to Russia, where Bolshevism won more or less by default because there was no one else capable of getting their act together, really. There was no one else in the landscape. And to my mind, a bloody civil war or a dictatorship were now inevitable in 1917 in Russia. I wouldn't have before anyone. So I think that's why Germany, I think, provides a much better example.
Right. We haven't formulated anything. I was going to ask you what the party had voted it at the time or after, but I'm not going to ask you that. I'm going to, well, you could comment on it later, but when the revolution came, it was, a country that had been affected, as you said, been affected by the blockade, and there was a challenge from the the German SDP, to overthrow this absolute sort of state or monarchy that still existed. Mm-hmm. Right, and yet these were the ones that were in Parliament prior to 1914, who voted for the war. Now, after the end of that, the war period, why was it that they took the step towards to remove the absolute monarchy or the powers there, the... And the other thing was that if the working class were so well organised in that sense, why was and the structures that they had in the 19th century, even up to the First World War, why weren't they then operative rather than the Soviets coming in, who seemed to be, although reflecting the dominant SDP line, why did they come into the tune rather than the organisational development that they had beforehand?
Right. On the first point, the theory regarding war in the Second International, which the SPD was part of, was that in any war you should support the most progressive side and should support wars of national defence. Now, in terms of what happened around the First World War was that the various social democratic parties across Europe each thought that it, or claimed, rather, to be supporting a war of national defence and opposing a reactionary force in Europe. In Germany, they claimed to be defending the most advanced working class in Europe, because they had the biggest party. And they were defending it from Russia and Russian Tsarism and, you know, Slavic tyranny. And the gains that they had there, so they felt that Russia would come down and take away anything they had. The French and the British likewise felt that they had to oppose, at least again, social democrats. Or, and people like the anarchist Peter Kropotkin took the view that German militarism was a threat, and that the Prussian state could expand outwards and could impose the similar sort of restrictions upon them as it did in Prussia and Germany. So the various and for also for nationalistic reasons, and who were concerned about not wanting to start a civil war or whatever, or be suppressed themselves, they had very vested interest in not being smashed. So they, that's why each national, the great crime of the Second International, each national party supported the First World War. But the SPD still maintained its idea of a democratic republic for Germany. That was still its goal. And it, in fact, claimed, many members have claimed, that defending the war was defending that project. They wouldn't have claimed that what happened was their intention, but they'd have claimed that that was what the interest of the war was about. Now, why they didn't use that organisation? Well, for one thing, there wasn't exactly political democracy in Germany. Partly you would have all sorts of various little Länder or statements all under Prussia. And then you'd have local councils. There wasn't a universal franchise as such. The political system wasn't set up for working class to have much of an access to. And basically, it was more or less the wave of a sudden change coming over people, of wanting to break down the final barrier to gain access to these things. So they set up the Soviets, particularly in copying the Bolshevik example. But they did use, obviously, the party structure, because the Soviets themselves were organised by political parties. Just as in Russia, the Bolsheviks were very friendly towards helping out organise the day-to-day running of the Soviets. They provided personnel for the administration of them. So too would have the SPD be one of the places in which they have recruited active organisers. That would have been your only source of them, because the people in the SPD were the ones with the experience of organising something. Plus, they were a known factor. So I think that's why it happened like that. It was more or less a stopgap for the shortcomings of the actual German political scene as was there. Two things that the revolution introduced were proportional representation in Parliament and the right for women to vote. They were more or less the immediate concrete gains, if you like, of the SPD's revolution.
In those Länder areas, were they who had the votes in actually in these areas that who were able to vote in, although there was another franchise across Germany at the time? Who were the people who were the ones that were able to vote?
I think it was a property qualification still, and it was male, men could vote. And then of course the town council would have been elected by burghers who would have been local petty bourgeois shop owners or local landowners and what have you, which people with property, so it's based very much on that sort of thing. Or on the sort of like junker military class, that would be, and then you have on top of that the fact that, a bit like in France and like in Russia, you had a military bureaucracy in which people with titles were set up to organize, or by the dint of being the local head of the DSS or whatever, you've got to be an archduke or something. That sort of thing. So the administration was in the hands of a very small select elite.
Yeah, I thought, first of all, Phil, really, really good talk. Yeah, really, really interesting. It was very interesting. It was quite a time. This is my home, I have some reasons to go back and look at the events again. This talk was generally based around 1989. I suppose what you would argue, but you never actually mentioned it. You know, the Weimar Republic, which was constituted in 1919, was basically the Linked assessment, the Social Democratic assessment of the New Republic of Germany. And of course, the thing is, all these events that we described reoccur again after that period, when the Weimar Republic failed, or when democracy, early democracy in Germany, failed, early the parliamentary experiment in Germany for the first time, failed due to the economic situation, which of course was initially exacerbated by the war operations. And by the occupation of the Ruhr by the French, for example, didn't have that at all. I think in a way, it's wrong to separate the Spartacist uprising from what was going on prior to that, as it would be to separate Spartacist uprising from what happened with what occurred after the Weimar Republic, say, back in 1919. In the sense that the revolution went back to the war sort of up to 1923. And you cannot really draw perhaps a firm line in the sand. For example, the argument about spontaneity. When you were saying that, I was thinking about this. You seem to be arguing workers' councils represented, in comparison to the Spartacist uprising, sort of like a static kind of situation. Germany was in a state of collapse, nobody knew where the centre of the land was. These workers' councils were set up, all their flaws, all their problems. That's true. Surely the important lesson, the first important lesson I draw from that information, is that the working class actually moved into action at all. And surely this is that even if it was to actually keep capitalist production going, and surely this has got to be the main opposition we face when talking to other members of the working class, is the problem of the working class ever acting on the historical stage at all. And we have examples, two wonderful examples, Russia and Germany, when the working class did assert itself on this world, as you have said. I think it's a question of emphasis for this. What the working class does and doesn't do when it asserts itself is a problem for the working class at the time, and for us as the descendants of those workers who made mistakes and who did X, Y, and Z, and could have done this, maybe could have done that, and perhaps that was wrong, that could be better than I was working. Whatever criticisms can be levelled at the workers' council and the factory committee system, which was predominant around that period, as it was in Russia and in other parts of Europe, could be the exact same criticism could be levelled at, say, the parliamentary situation of Weimar, for example, or prior to that. So I think the most important, the first lesson we can learn from the German Revolution, or we extrapolate any further lessons from it, is the fact that the working class acted to fill a political vacuum. No, not a political vacuum, a social vacuum, which is surely so important. How many times have we had conversations with workers and they believe that they and people like themselves are incapable of acting without somebody telling them what to do? You know, we're talking about another social class. The working class in Germany provided a wonderful example of that. Now, of course, that is historically, we know now that it's not happened at that time, quite diplomatic at the end, showing upon reflection, and with the benefit of hindsight, there are certain problems and certain issues that we're going to learn to. But showing them the basic lesson is the working class, when society broke down, showing to the key reason of any revolution, that when society broke down, when the social order collapsed, the working class was one social force which not only moved in and tried to reassert some form of social formation, but they almost became the vehicle by which the capitalist class themselves attempted to reconstitute their own order. That is actually paradoxically the kind of strength of what the working class were doing, but that they were the only social agency complete bourgeois revolution in Germany, because it could have gone one of two ways. It could have gone the bourgeois revolution, it could have gone the proletarian revolution. This is the whole point of the revolution situation, especially in a place like Germany, as you described, which didn't have the development which turned into Britain, or England, or in France, where everything was nice and spaced out. Germany came into the imperialism very, very late, and had to do a massive catch-up game, which it's still doing, of course, in the 1930s, which of course led directly to the Second World War. So, surely, once again, the basic lesson must be, working class, historically, when called upon to act, to do something, did.
Right, let's start. Yes, I agree entirely about the what you say about the Weimar settlement and that sort of thing, because part of what happened was, as a result of the Spartacus uprising, almost in part, and also the machinations of the various officers, they kept their head down for a while. The bureaucracy managed to keep itself intact. The officers managed to beat down the Hamburg Points, they were known as, which was a plan to reorganise the military, to cleanse it of Prussian militarism. And that sort of business stayed in power. Of course, what happened eventually was the great butcher himself, Hindenburg, who was responsible as a general for the wastage of so many German lives in the First World War, became the president of Germany. That's clear enough, and you're absolutely right that the Spartacist uprising and the election itself basically was a truce, more or less, rather than a final full stop. And it's a truce which is indicative of what was going to come ahead. I don't know if I necessarily separated out the Spartacist from all the other foregoing events. Obviously, that's it's partly drawn from a similar example, because the initial workers' councils had been drawn up by some workers acting of their own initiative and other people following them. And the Spartacists may well have been acting in that same vein. It's interesting to note that when they did rise up, there weren't any similar risings in the rest of the country. So even if they had, say, taken Berlin, it's questionable whether or not there would have been support for them outside of Berlin, or whether or not they would have ended up being... it's very comparable to Kronstadt, I think, the Berlin uprising. One city goes up, Kronstadt, Paris Commune, Berlin. One city goes up, no support in the rest of the country, the military move in and crush it. That's a sad story that we hear time and again. One that's a very important lesson to draw from it. I agree absolutely with what you say about the workers, the working class, being the determining force, particularly in Germany, because they were the only class that had any real social clout. In fact, I'd go further than yourself and say that what caused the ongoing friction with the capitalist class and from there on in and instability were the divisions within the workers themselves, as borne out by the existence of the SPD, USPD and KPD. The fact that the working class itself didn't know where it wanted to go was split, and this split was exploitable, meant that this fight would go on. Of course, there are other contributing facts like the hyperinflation in the 1920s and the abject failure of the SPD governments. But you're absolutely right in that eventually it was fascism, which generally speaking is defined as the capitalist class rising to power on the back of working class conscious support, particular sections of the working class, with a sort of workerist programme, eventually formed the settlement and produced the end of all the splits in Germany, right, which managed to be a successful and stable system in the end. So you're right that it was the self-activity of the workers, coupled with their own lack of their own divisions and lack of ideas, that created the Germany. Of course, those ideas don't come out of thin air, and they are themselves conditioned with the experience those workers had, obviously. But just as in, say, I think it's mentioned in the article in the Socialist Standard in the 1930s, a lot of people used Spanish Civil War against our case on parliamentarism. But the Socialist Standard pointed out, quite rightly, that the reason why Franco could feel confident in going forward and launching his coup d'etat was the Spanish working class was split as well, in that they did not present a united position. They were at war with themselves between the anarchists and the socialists, so-called, social democrats. And so Franco... Pardon me, too much water. And so Franco was able to exploit that particular division among them. So So I think it's you're absolutely right to say that the working class consciousness is the key, and that it took the working class winning the, to use the term to come from seriously, the hearts and minds of the workers in Germany to resolve that particular bout of instability that did go on for 10 or more years.
Yeah, I think to be honest, like David Bill had sort of covered most of the stuff that was going on. So maybe I'll just move slightly back to what you were saying before. I think it's interesting that some of the potential sort of degeneration, as it were, within the German SPD was actually, you know, charted and critiqued by Marx and Engels themselves. In the critique of the Goldberg program in Marx's case in 1871, and the critique of the effort program by Engels, which I think both of you know, but I'm getting on in years now and I'm going to play quoting on that. I think what I'm trying to sort of say was when they were saying that they were critiquing various programs that were being put forward to clarify what the actual aims and principles of the SPD could be, yeah? And they brought to light certain sort of inadequacies, which I think mainly sort of sprung up in, later on in later years around Edward Bernstein and the whole revisionist sort of controversy at the beginning of the 20th century. And I think that lies at the roots of the action that Bill described, you know, to Conrad. That's why the SPD, for example, supported the war.
That's, I mean, I've got here the Socialist Standard from February 1919, and that what you just said is pretty much what they write here. That, like I said, very small capitalists had to join in with the socialists to produce the SPD, and of course they pursued the capitalist program of open democracy and liberalism. So, and they say here that from the Goethe program onwards, Marx and Engels criticised that particular strain, which was the, we say, radical democratic strain of the SPD.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Anyone who wants to speak on that?
From good to serve, and it's a quote from the KPD Central Committee. This is on 1923. This is to do with the basic factors formed by Germany at the time. The fascists count on winning the civil war by the most resolute use of violence and crushing brutality. Any workers who resist them are then taken prisoner, will be executed. The great strikes, they will go so far as to shoot every tenth striker. Their violent coup can only be stopped by meeting white terror with red terror. If the fascist armed critique shoot our proletarian fighters, they will find us implacable and determined to destroy them. If they put every tenth striker up against the wall, the revolutionary workers will kill one fascist in the fire. This is what one of them will call that.
That's the situation as was facing them. Although it's intriguing, obviously, as most people note, that Hitler's eventual ascendancy to political power came from a collapse in the Communist Party vote in favour of the fascists. Their supporters switched allegiance, and there was elements. I mean, obviously, like I was saying, the fascists drew a lot of their support from the working class, so there was elements of the KPD, the National Bolsheviks, and that sort of thing, who went straight over to the NSDAP, Hitler's fascist party. By that time, yes, there was pretty much open civil war between those two groups, fighting for the leadership of the working class. Of course, the German state had every interest at that time in not intervening, and in wanting to have the fascists as a sort of armed auxiliary of their own organisation, which is eventually why they got brought into power on behalf of the capitalist class, trying to use the workers against themselves. With regards to that sort of, it's a bit like the speech in The Untouchables, that someone asked the hospital to send one of those to the morgue. Well, I don't know how far that would have got them. They obviously didn't get them very far because they lost. And they lost because Hitler won the political game. Right, once he got his hand on the state, he was able to use it to back up his case. I think there's something in here about it. Once you have the state and the army behind you, and to the Russia, then you have to not be military force, and of course you're going to win out. And for so long as the workers were split and fighting among themselves, obviously that sort of civil war in the streets is pretty much inevitable.
Pat.
I wonder what you think, and I'm not quite sure what you were saying, not the what would be achieved, given that it wasn't achieved, and what happened as it were. What do you think could have been achieved for the Working Council? And I don't know how extensive they were, and given that there was not a was not a majority of socialists in Germany at the time. The SDP or SDP, they sort of became the government, and that suited the capitalists. They became the government at that very difficult time in Germany. And I've heard it said that it was their failure that
Well, it's always difficult to work out sort of like the hypotheticals of these things. Like you said, it's a bit like the question, what else could have happened in Russia? This sort of thing. I mean, on the one hand, if you go to the argument and say, if the Spartakists hadn't had their uprising and had backed the SPD, well, it must have been might have been able to engineer some sort of stable liberal democracy. But the ship of international economics, or the international economic tide, would have wrecked that just as surely as it wrecked the Weimar Republic. So it's, I don't think there's anything that we can. They probably achieved what was possible to achieve in those sort of terms. I doubt that the very best they could achieve would be to dismantle the old military bureaucracy. And to have ended sort of like German militarism and ended the influence of the army, which to a certain extent fascism arose, I mean, Hitler and a lot of his cohorts arose from elements within the army forming the political party in reaction to the attacks upon the party as such, in opposition to a liberal constitution. So I can't see what really could have been different. I mean, I think it's important for others to look at what did happen and to draw the lessons in advance for our own situation, and look at it from that perspective of what could be done before the ship was sailed. If you're talking in terms of what had been done after, say, 1914, what different actions would have been taken, well, there's not a lot that would have made much difference, I don't think. There could have been a few less people did it. They'd have organised themselves better for the uprisings in Berlin, or instead of held back a bit further, used different political means, and used a bit more now. So these are various variables that we'll find in any of these situations. But a lot of people will play what-ifs with to defend their own political programmes. You know, CLR James sort of talked about, if there had been a Trotsky or a Lenin there, then of course they'd have won, because Trotsky and Lenin would have set down a national plan and organised it and been great tacticians and manipulators. So I think that the main thing, the lesson to draw on is that, as Dave said, the consciousness of the workers and the unity of the working class is the most important factor in any sort of political situation. That's what we've got to draw on the most.
Dave.
Yeah, a couple of points I want to put away. First of all, going on towards the succession of Hitler, yeah, the KVD obviously depended on Stalin for a while, and Trotsky and his left opposition developed the theory of the United Front, which was the idea that the SPD and the NPD should work together with the United Front against the fascists. Of course, Stalin was arguing for the Communist Party, but the SPD and all other organisations outside the NPD were social fascists, therefore no United Front could occur. And Stalin Trotsky was understanding certainly that some part of the SPD was that if there had been a United Front between the SPD and the KPD, the working class could unify on the sort of centre-left ticket. In other words, prevent polarisation between extreme left and extreme right. So first of all, on that Trotskyist tactic of the United Front, I'd like to think about that. Could a United, this is the question, could a United Front between the KPD and the SPD have prevented the rise of Nazism? And secondly, Now clearly there wasn't a majority of socialists. And I think the German Revolution has become probably a lot similar, more similar than the Bolshevik Revolution, or sort of the Russian Revolution, as which involved the Bolsheviks. It's going to be more similar to the revolution which is hopefully going to occur, the world socialist revolution in the future. So I think the situation is going to be more similar to the German situation, in the sense that you can have a state of flux situation, and all these different working class groups claiming in a vacuum, claiming to be of the working class. Surely the question of consciousness has to be evaluated within that context. What I mean by that is that the only way we can get the job to service, unfortunately, is going through this rather messy process. Because without that missing process, and of course without the revolution itself, you will never get a majority of socialists. You will never go from the situation we are in today, a nice benign situation, to a majority of socialists. The only way you're going to go through it is through a revolution. And a revolution, by its very nature, for any revolution in history, involves social disputation, involves loads of different opinions being thrown into the melting pot. And it's precisely in that environment where working class socialists will be forged, or in the case of the German Revolution, will not be forged. But that is part and parcel, I believe, the only serious materialist analysis you can have would be to say that that is the context in which consciousness arises. It doesn't arise from the battle of ideas alone. It's a combination of the battle of ideas in the context of a revolutionary upheaval, which in itself is messy, which in itself probably would like to have not Germany, 1918 to 1923. So the two questions there. Second one on consciousness, first one on Trotsky's United Front.
Right, on the United Front, before you even ask the question, you talk about the United Front, and I put down a little note myself, cobblers. Basically, you can look at this in a very simple way. A lot of people tend to analyse the voting figures in the rise of the fascists in terms of the Nazi Party and their associated bloc as compared to the SPD and the KPD and their associated bloc. And the fact of the matter is that it was the collapse in their bloc vote that led to Hitler winning. So it seemed like if they had been united front of some sort, that would probably just driven a lot more of those ex-communists into the hands of the Nazis, because obviously it was something in the Nazi program about, its workerist content, its Strasserism, that sort of business, that appealed to a certain element of the radical working class at that time, and was able to absorb them and then nullify them. As to consciousness, I agree to a great extent that I think the German model does serve us possibly well, because I would say that the necessary factor is that we should be where the SPD were, as, say, a huge socialist movement with its ideas well known in advance and was already a living force that was the main or predominant political idea within the working class, would be the precondition for being able to win out in that situation, because the SPD won because they were the clear majority of workers. They had the dominant ideas there. They had the support of the majority of the working class. Because, I mean, the situation you describe is exactly like Portugal. In Portugal, there were... I mean, I mentioned leftist alphabetic spaghetti here, but Portugal, it went insane. There were every combination of peoples, workers, communists, socialists, every combination you could get. The list was that long, you know, they were all of them out there, Maoists, Trotskyists, Stalinists, Leninists, out there, leafleting everywhere across Portugal. And in two elections, despite the fact that Leninists controlled the military, the Social Democrats won out again and again. But I would agree that you're right, that we will know the revolution is not on the way, so it ceases to be us arguing versus Trotskyists or us arguing versus Labourists, to the days when we're packing holes between us arguing against council communists, us arguing against anarchists, and that will be the day when the revolution is on its way, is when those sorts of ideas become the ones that are splitting the workers, not between parliamentarism, not parliamentarism, but between councilism, socialist partyism, on this sort of business. That will be the deciding date and the deciding closing act of capitalism. And I certainly think that it is possible for us to be in the sort of same situation as this, because the SPD existed under conditions of long-term harassment and repression long before it arose in this situation, so it managed to grow in that situation. I think that's where the German model provides for, and then it also provides for what happens if someone else gets their hands on the state and we try and go against it in the way, the almost anarchist way that the Council of Communists in Germany did, of trying to provoke a confrontation between the working class and their state. But the result of that confrontation was that they got their asses for.
Stuart. Hold on. No. Okay, Stuart.
Yeah. It's related to what you just talked about. You might have well have answered this in a bit of your background on this. I was interested in how the Social Democrats in Germany managed to get that level of support in Germany, more from the point of view of what it's actually like in Germany politically compared to what it's like now, given the control, presumably tighter control over the media, etc., etc. I mean, is there any lessons from how the SPD grew in Germany? Are there any lessons there that are at all applicable to our situation? Or is it today a case of,
Well, the reason why, on the one hand, the SPD grew, like I said, I did mention, was that because Germany was relatively economically underdeveloped, and it was capitalised by the military bureaucratic state rather than by private capitalists individually on their own, it drew up an organised working class that could import its ideas from abroad on the one hand, and that was socially more powerful than any actual capitalist class on the other. So although the capitalists were growing, inevitably they were producing workers faster than they were getting on power, whereas the English bourgeoisie came to power and then proceeded to make a working class, more or less, or at least found the field of political combat, the workers either on their side in the first place or weren't there to oppose them. So the working class were already organised in the more powerful land of the capitalists there, and they were criminalised. But they were drawn up. I don't know the exact history of the SPD, but it was people like Wilhelm Liebknecht, Ferdinand Lassalle, Karl Marx, corresponding with each other and setting up various sections of the international in various areas. More or less filling up an organisational vacuum being created by the birthdays of the working class in Germany. With regards to its relevance for us, I mean, when I told the old man what I was going to talk about today, he says, well, it was an entirely different world back then, wasn't it, because of the mass media? And that does form a huge difference between then and now. I mean, partly it shows the difference of how the fascists won out, because part of fascism was some embracing of mass culture and mass political organisation compared to the older fashioned formats. and it's very effective use and control of the media. That said, obviously because the SPD was banned and had no media access itself because it was censored, it had to grow up through a sort of word of mouth network through various local connections and institute itself in the form of socialist riding clubs, socialist walking clubs and what have you, as a social, more of a movement, more of a cultural event than a political party in that sort of sense. Just something I was going to mention when I was talking about Dave, to Dave's points. The person I asked to get this interview for me is Dave. When she was talking about it, she expressed a certain degree of amazement of how, when the workers or when people in Germany had thrown up all these councils across the country, how they could have lost so badly. Which is obviously one of the interesting questions. How is it that they were capable of this immense political earthquake that obviously she, as a German citizen, hasn't heard much about it in her childhood or in her day to day life? This revolution, and how it could dissolve so easily and so rapidly. One suggestion has been put to me that it's because they didn't want to go in that particular sense, that they got what they wanted at the end of the day. But as to your question, yeah, I think the difference to the media is one that has to be examined. But there were advanced means of communication then, and there were censorship laws on the SPD. That has a bearing.
Thanks.
meetings in village halls and so on, and